Sectional issue with the Missouri Compromise. The fire bell in the night. Opening Missouri to statehood brought on yet another, but up to that point the most important, of many clashes over slavery that ended in secession and war. Proponents of slavery had started to develop the first overtly distinct Southern constitutional thought that crafted a logical but constitutionally flawed defense of individual states' rights to protect slavery. Once again, it was Jefferson who influenced both the advance of liberty and the expansion of slavery simultaneously. For it was in the southern regions of the Louisiana Purchase Territory, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Kansas, and Missouri, that slavery's future lay. Difficulties over the admission of Missouri began in late 1819, when Missouri applied to Congress for statehood. At the time, there were 11 slave states: Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and 11 free states: New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. Population differences produced a disparity in House seats, where even with the 3/5 ratio working in favor of the South, slave states only counted 81 votes to 105 held by free states. Moreover, free state population had already started to grow substantially faster than that of the slave states. Missouri's statehood threatened to shift the balance of power in the Senate in the short term, but in the long term it would likely set a precedent for the entire Louisiana Purchase Territory. Anticipating that eventuality, and that since Louisiana had already become a state in 1812, the South would try to further open Louisiana Purchase lands to slavery, Congressman James Talmadge of New York introduced an amendment to the statehood legislation that would have prevented further introduction of slaves into Missouri. A firestorm erupted. Senator Rufus King of New York claimed the Constitution empowered Congress to prohibit slavery in Missouri and to make prohibition a prerequisite for admission to the Union. As a quick reference, his could be labeled the congressional authority view, which was quickly countered by Senator William Pinckney of Maryland, who articulated what might be called the compact view, wherein he asserted that the United States was a collection of equal sovereignties, and Congress lacked the constitutional authority over those sovereignties. Indeed, the Constitution said nothing about territories, much less slavery in the territories, and left it to the statute law to provide guidance. That was the case with the Northwest Ordinance. But since the Louisiana Purchase was not a part of the United States in 1787, the Northwest Ordinance made no provision for slavery west of the Mississippi, necessitating some new measure. No sooner had the opposing positions been laid out than the Territory of Maine petitioned Congress for its admission to the Union as well, allowing for not only sectional balance, but also providing a resolution combining the Maine and Missouri applications. A further compromise prohibited slavery north of the 36-degree 30-minute line. There were also more insidious clauses that prohibited free black migration in the territory and guaranteed that masters could take their slaves into free states, which reaffirmed the state definitions of citizenship in the latter case and denied certain citizenship protections to free blacks in the former. Packaging the entire group of bills together so that the Senate and House would have to vote on the entirety of the measure, preventing anti-slave Northerners from peeling off distasteful sections, was the brainchild of Henry Clay of Kentucky. More than any other person, Clay directed the passage of the compromise and staked his claim to the title later given him, the Great Compromiser. Some, perhaps including Clay, thought that with passage of the Missouri Compromise, the question of slavery had been effectively dealt with. Others, however, including Martin Van Buren of New York, concluded just the opposite. It set in motion a dynamic that he was convinced would end only in disunion or war. Van Buren consequently devised a solution to this eventuality. His brilliant but flawed plan rested on certain assumptions that we must examine. Southern prospects for perpetuating slavery depended on maintaining a grip on the levers of power at the federal level, but the South had already lost the House of Representatives. Southerners could count on the votes of enough border states to ensure that no abolition bill could be passed, but little else. Power in the Senate, meanwhile, had started to shift, and with each new state receiving two senators, it would only take a few more states from the northern section of the Louisiana Purchase to tilt the balance forever against the South in the upper chamber. That meant forcing a balance in the admission of all new states. Finally, the South had to hold on to the presidency. This did not seem difficult, for it seemed highly likely that the South could continue to ensure the election of presidents who would support the legality, if not the morality, of slavery. But the courts troubled slave owners, especially when it came to retrieving runaways, which was nearly impossible. The best strategy for controlling the courts was to control the appointment of the judges through a pro-slavery president and Senate. Still, the ability of the non-slave states to outvote the South and its border allies would only grow, hence Jefferson's observation that the compromise was a reprieve only, not a final sentence. Anyone politically astute could foresee a time in the not-distant future when not only would both houses of Congress have northern anti-slave majorities, but the South would also lack the electoral clout to guarantee a pro-slavery president. On top of these troublesome realities lay moral traps that the territories represented. Bluntly, if slavery was evil in the territories, was it not equally evil in the Carolinas? And if it was morally acceptable for Mississippi, why not Minnesota? These issues combined with the election of 1824 to lead to the creation of the modern two-party system and the founding of the Democratic Party. The father of the modern Democratic Party, without question, was Martin Van Buren, who had come from the Bucktail faction of the Republican Party. As the son of a tavern owner from Kinderhook, New York, Van Buren resented the aristocratic landowning families and found enough other like-minded politicians to control the New York State Constitutional Convention in 1821, enacting universal manhood suffrage. On a small scale, suffrage reflected the strategy Van Buren intended to see throughout the nation— an uprising against the privileged classes, and a radical democratization of the political process. He learned to employ newspapers as no other political figure had, linking journalists' success to the fortunes of the party. Above all, Van Buren perceived the necessity of discipline and organization, which he viewed as beneficial to the masses he sought to organize. Yet Van Buren personally embodied the contradictions the Democratic Party would soon exhibit, espousing liberty while protecting slavery. Van Buren had inherited a slave from his father, the slave ran off, when he was a teenager, but developed a sharp distaste for the institution. While working local and state politics in New York, Van Buren hit upon the strategy he intended to use throughout the nation by focusing on suffrage, that is, getting out the vote. This constituted an uprising against the privileged classes and a radical democratization of the political process, yet one greased by the awards of party and government jobs. As one political opponent marveled of Van Buren's patronage network in New York, the wires of political machinery were attached to strings in every county. He learned to employ newspapers as no other political figure had, linking journalists' success to the fortunes of the party. As Duff Green, one of his editor allies, wrote, "Party is everything." Even while he took Van Buren's money, Green recognized the dangers of a politicized press, writing in 1826, "It is in vain to talk of a free press when the favor of power is essential to the support of editors, and the money of the people, by passing through the hands of the executive, is made to operate as a bribe against liberty." Above all, Van Buren perceived the necessity of discipline and organization, which he viewed as beneficial to the masses he sought to organize. With his allies in the printing businesses, Van Buren's party covered the state with handbills, posters, editorials, and even ballots. Van Buren's plan also took into account the liberalization of voting requirements in the states. By 1820, most states had abandoned property requirements for voting, greatly increasing the electorate, and, contrary to expectations, voter participation fell. In fact, when property restrictions were in place, voter participation was the highest in American history. More than 70% participation in Mississippi, 1823, and Missouri, 1820. More than 80% in Delaware, 1804, and New Hampshire, 1814. And an incredible 97% of those eligible voting in 1819. The key to getting out the vote in the new larger but less vested electorate was a hotly contested election, especially where parties were most evenly balanced. There occurred the highest voter turnout with spectacular increases in Maine, New Hampshire, the Middle States, Kentucky, and Ohio. Or, put another way, good old-fashioned partisanship of the type Madison had extolled energized the electorate. Van Buren absorbed the impact of these changes. He relished confrontation. Known as the Little Magician or the Red Fox of Kinderhook, Van Buren organized a group of party leaders in New York, referred to as the Albany Regency, to direct a national campaign. Whereas some scholars make it appear that Van Buren only formed the new party in reaction to what he saw as John Quincy Adams's outright theft of the 1824 election, he had in fact already put the machinery in motion for much different reasons. For one thing, he disliked what today would be called a new tone in Washington, Monroe's willingness to appoint former Federalists to government positions, or a practice called the Monroe Heresy. The New Yorker wanted conflict and wanted it hot as a means to exclude the hated Federalists from power. The election of 1824, at best, provided a stimulant for the core ideas for future action already formed in Van Buren's brain. Hence, he saw the Missouri Compromise as a threat and, at the same time, an opportunity. Intuitively, Van Buren recognized that the immorality of slavery and the South's intransigence on it would lead to secession and possibly a war. His solution was to somehow prevent the issue from even being discussed in the political context, an objective he sought to attain through the creation of a new political party dedicated to no other principle than holding power. When the Jeffersonians killed off the Federalist Party, they lost their identity. As the party of the whole nation, the Republican Party ceased to be responsive to any particular elements in its constituency. It ceased to be responsive to the South. As he would later outline in an 1827 letter to Virginian Thomas Ritchie, Van Buren argued that political combinations between the inhabitants of the different states are unavoidable, and the most natural and beneficial to the country is that between the planters of the South and the plain Republicans of the North. This alliance, soon called the Richmond-Albany Axis, joined the Free Soil Van Buren with the old Richmond Junto, which included Ritchie, editor of the Inquirer, and other Southern leaders, including William Crawford of Georgia. Without a national party system, he contended, the clamor against the Southern influence and African slavery would increase. But on the other hand, if Van Buren successfully managed to align with Southern interests, how could his party avoid the charge of being pro-slavery in campaigns? The answer, he concluded, rested in excluding slavery from the national debate in entirety. If, through party success and discipline, he could impose a type of moratorium on all discussion of slavery issues, the South and the nation would be safe. Thus appeared the Jacksonian Democratic Party, or simply, the Democrats. Van Buren's vision for maintaining national unity evolved from the notion that money corrupts, a point that Andrew Jackson himself would make repeatedly and which Jefferson endorsed. And therefore, the majority was strongest where it was purest, least subject to the corrupting power of money, which was the South. Ironically, it was exactly the corrupting power of money that Van Buren intended to harness in order to enforce discipline. The growing size of the federal government, especially in some departments like the post office, provided an ever larger pool of government jobs with which to reward supporters. At the state level, too, governments were growing. Van Buren realized that when federal, state, local, and party jobs were combined, they provided a significant source of compensation for the most loyal party leaders. Certainly not everyone would receive a government or party job, but a hierarchy was established from precinct to ward to district to state to the national level through which effective partisans were promoted. Then, when they had attained a statewide level of success, they were converted into federal or state employees. This structure relied on an American tradition, the spoils system, in which the winner of the election replaced all the government bureaucrats with his own supporters. Hence, to the victor belonged the spoils. It was also called patronage. However one defined it, the bottom line was jobs and money. Van Buren hitched his star to a practice that at its root viewed men as base and without principle. If people could be silenced on the issue of slavery by a promise of a job, what kind of integrity did they have? Yet that was precisely Van Buren's strategy, to buy off votes in a roundabout way with jobs for the noble purpose of saving the nation from a civil war. In turn, the spoils system inordinately relied on a fiercely partisan and often nasty press to churn out reasons to vote for the appropriate candidate and to besmirch the record and integrity of the opponent. All the papers were wholly owned subsidiaries of the political parties and usually carried the party name in the masthead, for example, Arkansas Democrat. Such partisan papers had existed in the age of the Federalists, who benefited from Noah Webster's The Minerva and Jefferson's counterpart, Freneau's National Gazette. But they were much smaller organizations, and certainly not coordinated in a nationwide network of propaganda as Van Buren envisioned. Under the new partisan press, all pretense of objective news vanished. One editor wrote that he saw it as irresponsible to be objective, and any paper which pretended to be fair simply was not doing its job. Readers understood that the papers did not pretend to be unbiased, and therefore they took what they found with an appropriate amount of skepticism. There was another dynamic at work in the machinery that Van Buren set up, one that he likely had not thought through, especially given his free soil predilections. Preserving a slave South free from Northern interference not only demanded politicians who would, in exchange for patronage, loyally submit to a party gag order, but also required the party elect as president a man who would not use the power of the federal government to infringe on slavery. The successful candidate, for all practical purposes, had to be a Northern man of Southern principles, or Southerners who were predominantly Westerners in the public eye. As long as the territorial issues were managed, and as long as the White House remained in safe hands with a sympathetic Northerner or a Westerner with sufficient Southern dispositions, the South could rest easy. Unwittingly, though, Van Buren and other early founders of the new Democratic Party had already sown the seeds of disaster for their cause. Keeping the issue of slavery bottled up demanded that the federal government stay out of Southern affairs. That, in turn, required a relatively small and unobtrusive Congress, a pliant bureaucracy, and a docile chief executive. These requirements fell by the wayside almost immediately, if not inevitably. Certainly, the man that Van Buren ultimately helped put in the White House, Andrew Jackson, was anything but docile. But even if Jackson had not been the aggressive president he was, Van Buren's spoils system put in place a doomsday device that guaranteed that the new Jacksonian Democrats would have to deal with the slavery issues sooner rather than later. With each new federal patronage job added, the bureaucracy and the power of Washington grew proportionately. Competition was sure to come from a rival party, which would also promise jobs. To get elected, politicians increasingly had to promise more jobs than their opponents, proportionately expanding the scope and power of the federal government. The last thing Van Buren and the Democrats wanted was a large, powerful central government that could fall into the hands of an anti-slave party. But the process they created to stifle debate on slavery ensured just that. By the 1850s, all it would take to set off a crisis was the election of the wrong man, a Northerner of Northern principles, someone like Abraham Lincoln. Other charges accelerated the trend toward mass national parties. Conventions had already come into vogue for securing passage of favored bills to marshal the support of the people and the common man. Conventions satisfied the great political touchstone of Jacksonian democracy, popular sovereignty. Reflecting the democratic impulses that swept the nation, the nominating convention helped bury King Caucus. It was the election of 1824, however, that killed the king. Corrupt bargains? A precedent of some degree had been set in American politics from the beginning when, aside from Vice President Adams, the strongest contender to succeed a president was the Secretary of State. Jefferson, Washington's Secretary of State, followed Adams. Madison, who was Jefferson's Secretary of State, followed Jefferson. Monroe, Madison's Secretary of State, followed Madison, and John Quincy Adams, Monroe's Secretary of State, now intended to keep the string intact. Advantages accompanied the position. It had notoriety and, when the man holding the job was competent, a certain publicity for leadership traits whenever important treaties were negotiated. It was one of the few jobs that offered foreign policy experience outside of the presidency itself. Nevertheless, Adams's personal limitations made the election of 1824 the most closely and bitterly fought in the life of the young republic. John Quincy Adams, the former president's son, had benefited from his family name, but it also saddled him with the unpleasant association of his father's Anglophilia, the general aroma of distrust that had hung over the first Adams administration, and above all, the perception of favoritism and special privilege that had become aspersions in the new age of the common man. Adams suffered from chronic depression. He had two brothers and a son die of alcoholism, whereas his self-righteousness reminded far too many of his father's piousness. Unafraid of hard work, Adams disdained politicking and refused to play the spoils system. Like Clay, he was an avowed nationalist whose concepts for internal unity harkened back to, indeed far surpassed, the old Federalist programs. But in 1808, to remain politically viable, Adams abandoned the Federalists and became a Republican. To some extent, Adams was overqualified to be president. Even the slanted Jackson biographer Robert Remini agreed that, unquestionably, Adams was the best qualified for the job, unless, he added, political astuteness counted. Having served as U.S. minister to Russia and having helped draft the Treaty of Ghent, Adams had excellent foreign policy skills. Intelligent, well-educated, and fiercely anti-slave, he later defended the Amistad rebels, Adams nevertheless, like his father, elicited little personal loyalty and generated only the smallest spark of political excitement. Worse, he seemed unable or unwilling to address his faults. "I am a man of reserved, cold, austere, and forbidding manners," he wrote, and indeed he was called by his political adversaries a gloomy misanthrope, character defects that he admitted he lacked the pliability to reform. Another equally flawed contender, Henry Clay of Kentucky, had a stellar career as Speaker of the House and a reputation as a miracle worker when it came to compromises. If anyone could make the lion lie down with the lamb, wasn't it Henry Clay? He had revolutionized the Speaker's position, turning it into a partisan office empowered by constitutional authority that had simply lain dormant since the founding. Clay had beaten the drums for war in 1812, then extended the olive branch at Ghent in 1815. A ladies' man, he walked with an aura of power, magnified by a gift of oratory few could match, which, when combined with his near-Napoleonic hypnotism, simultaneously drew people to him and repulsed them. John Calhoun, who opposed the Kentuckian in nearly everything, admitted, "I don't like Clay, but by God I love him." The Kentuckian could just as easily explode in fury or weep in sympathy. He could dance well, and he could duel, and he could attract the support of polar opposites such as Davy Crockett and John Quincy Adams. Possessing so much, Clay lacked much as well. His ideology hung together as a garment of fine but incompatible cloths. Having done as much as anyone to keep the nation from a civil war, Henry Clay, in modern terminology, was a moderate, afraid to offend either side too deeply. Like Webster and Jackson, he stood for union. But what was that? Did union mean compact? Did it mean confederation? Did it mean all men are created equal? Clay supposedly opposed slavery in principle and wanted it banned. Yet, like the sage of Monticello, he and his wife never freed their own slaves. Ever the conciliator, Clay sought the middle ground on the peculiar institution, searching for some process to make the unavoidable disappear without conflict. He thought slavery was not a competitive economic structure in the long run, and thus all that was needed was a national market to ensure slavery's demise, all the while turning profits off slavery. Such inconsistencies led him to construct a political platform, along with other nationalists like Adams and Daniel Webster, that envisioned binding the nation together in a web of commerce, whereupon slavery would disappear peacefully. Clay's American system, not to be confused with Eli Whitney's manufacturing process of the same name, involved three fundamental objectives. 1. Tie the country together with a system of internal improvements, including roads, harbor clearances, river improvements, and later railroads, all built with federal help. 2. Support the Bank of the United States, which had branches throughout the nation and provided a uniform money. And 3. Maintain a system of protective tariffs for southern sugar, northeastern textiles, and iron. What was conspicuous by its absence was abolition of slavery. Without appreciating the political similarities of the American system, Clay had advanced a program that conceptually mirrored Van Buren's plans for political dominance. The American system offered, in gussied-up terms, payoffs to constituent groups, who in return would ignore the subject standing in front of them all. Thus, between Adams and Clay, the former had the will but not the skill to do anything about slavery, whereas the latter had the skill but not the will. That opened the door for yet another candidate, William Crawford of Georgia. Originally, Van Buren had his eye on Crawford as the natural leader of his fledgling Democratic Party. Unlike Adams and Clay, however, Crawford stood for slavery, veiled in the principles of 1798, as he called them, and strict construction of the Constitution. Lacking any positive message, Crawford naturally appealed to a minority, building a base only in Virginia and Georgia. But he appealed to Van Buren because of his willingness to submit government control to party discipline. Van Buren therefore swung the caucus behind the Georgian. Instead of providing a boost to Crawford, the endorsement of him sparked a revolt on the grounds that Van Buren was engaging in kingmaking. Van Buren should have seen this Democratic tide coming, as he had accounted for it in almost everything else he did. But he learned his lesson after the election. Crawford's candidacy also suffered mightily in 1823, when the giant man was hit by a stroke and left nearly paralyzed. And although he won some electoral votes in the election of 1824, he no longer was an attractive candidate for national office. None of the three major candidates, Adams, Clay, or Crawford, in fact, could claim to be of the people. All were viewed as elites, which left room for one final entry into the presidential sweepstakes, Andrew Jackson of Tennessee. Beginning with the Tennessee legislature, then followed by Pennsylvania, Jackson was endorsed at a mass meeting. Sensing his opportunity, Jackson ensured Southern support by encouraging John C. Calhoun to run for vice president. Jackson appeared to have the election secure, having mastered the techniques Van Buren espoused, such as avoiding commitment on key issues and, above all, avoiding the slavery issue. When the ballots came in to the Electoral College, no one had a majority, so the decision fell to the House of Representatives. There, only the three receiving the highest electoral count could be considered, and that eliminated Clay, who had won only 37 electoral votes. The contest now came down to Jackson with 99, Adams with 84, and Crawford with 41. Clay, the Speaker of the House, found himself in the position of kingmaker because his 37 electoral votes could tip the balance. And Clay detested Jackson. "I cannot believe that killing 2,500 Englishmen at New Orleans qualifies for the duties of the first magistracy," he opined. Clay should have known better. Washington before him had ridden similar credentials to the presidency. Nevertheless, between Crawford's physical condition and Clay's view of the hero of New Orleans, he reluctantly threw his support to Adams. He had genuine agreements with Adams on the American system as well, whereas Crawford and Jackson opposed it. Whatever his thinking, Clay's decision represented a hideously short-sighted action. Jackson had won the popular vote by a large margin over Adams, had beaten Adams and Clay put together, and had the most electoral votes. No evidence has ever surfaced that Clay and Adams had made a corrupt bargain, but none was needed in the minds of the Jacksonians, who viewed Clay's support of Adams as acquired purely through bribery. Nor was anyone surprised when Adams named Clay Secretary of State in the new administration. Jackson exploded. "The Judas of the West has closed the contract and will receive the 30 pieces of silver, but his end will be the same." It mattered little that Clay, in fact, had impeccable credentials for the position. Rather, the great compromiser muddied the waters by offering numerous, often conflicting explanations for his conduct. Meanwhile, Calhoun, who saw his own chances at the presidency vanish in an Adams-Clay coalition, threw in completely with the Jacksonians, and overnight Adams created an instant opposition built on the single objective of destroying his administration. Adams's stillborn administration. At every turn, Adams found himself one step behind Jackson and the Van Buren machine. Lacking an affinity for the masses, even though he spent countless hours receiving ordinary citizens daily, dutifully recording their meetings in his diary, Adams seemed incapable of cultivating any public goodwill. In his first message to Congress, Adams laid out an astounding array of plans, including exploration of the Far West, the funding of a naval academy and a national astronomical observatory, and the institution of a uniform set of metric weights and measures. Then, in one of the most famous faux pas of any elected official, Adams lectured Congress that the members were not to be palsied by the will of our constituents. Bad luck and poor timing characterized the hapless Adams administration, which soon sought to pass a new tariff bill to raise revenue for the government, a purpose that seldom excited voters. When the tariff of 1824 finally navigated its way through Congress, it featured higher duties on cotton, iron, salt, coffee, molasses, sugar, and virtually all foreign manufactured goods. Legislators enthusiastically voted for duties on some products to obtain higher prices for those made by their own constituents, hardly noticing that if all prices went up, what came into one hand went out of the other. Calhoun saw an opportunity to twist the legislation even further, giving the Jacksonians a political victory. He He wrote a bill that introduced outrageously high duties on raw materials, which the Machiavellian Calhoun felt certain would result in the northeastern states voting it down along with the agricultural states. As legislation sometimes does, the bill advanced bit by bit, largely out of the public eye. What finally emerged threatened to blow apart the Union. The stunned Calhoun saw Van Buren's Northerners support it on the grounds that it protected his woolen manufacturing voters, whereas Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, one of those Calhoun thought would be painted into a corner, backed the tariff on the principle that he supported all protective tariffs, even one that high. Thus, to Calhoun's amazement and the dismay of Southern and Western interests, the bill actually passed in May 1828, leaving Calhoun to attack his own bill. He penned anonymously the South Carolina Exposition and Protest, and quickly the tariff was dubbed the Tariff of Abominations. As the next election approached, on the one side stood Jackson, who, despite his military record, seemed a coarse man of little character. At the other extreme stood the equally unattractive Adams, who thought that only character counted. Jackson and his followers believed in rotation in office, whereby virtually any individual could be plugged into any government job. The Whigs, on the other hand, emphasized character and social standing. To Adams and other later Whigs, simply stacking men of reputation in offices amounted to good government. Common experience at the end of Adams's term suggested that some men of character lacked sense, and some men of sense seemed to lack character. Therefore, sometime after Jefferson, the fine balance that demanded both effectiveness and honor among elected officials had taken a holiday. The Rise of the Common Man. Hailed by many historians as the first true democratic election in American history, the contest of 1828 was nearly a foregone conclusion, owing to the charges of the corrupt bargain and the inept political traits of the incumbent Adams. The 4 years of the Adams administration actually benefited Van Buren's political machine, giving him the necessary time to line up the papers, place the proper loyalists in position, and obtain funding. By 1828, all the pieces were in place. Adams's supporters could only point to Jackson's convicted adulteress of a wife, the legal status of her earlier divorce had been successfully challenged, and his hanging of the British spies in Florida, going so far as to print up handbills with two caskets on them, known fittingly as the coffin handbills. Modern Americans, disgusted by supposedly negative campaigning, have little appreciation for the intense vitriol of early American politics, which makes 21st century squabbles tame by comparison. Jackson and his vice president, John Calhoun, coasted into office, winning 178 electoral votes to Adams's 83, in the process claiming all the country except the Northeast, Delaware, and Maryland. Old Hickory, as he was now called, racked up almost 150,000 more popular votes than Adams. Jackson quickly proved more of an autocrat than either of the Adamses, but on the surface his embrace of rotation in office and the flagrant use of the spoils system to bring in multitudes of people previously out of power seemed democratic in the extreme. More than 10,000 celebrants and job seekers descended on Washington like locusts, completely emptying the saloons of all liquor in a matter of days. Washington had no place to put them, even when gouging them to the tune of $20 per week for hotel rooms. Webster, appalled at the rabble, said, "They really seem to think the country has been rescued from some general disaster." While Clay succinctly identified their true objective, "Give us bread, give us treasury pap, give us our reward." The real shock still awaited Washingtonians. After an inaugural speech that no one could hear, Jackson bowed deeply to the crowd before mounting his white horse to ride to the presidential mansion, followed by the enormous horde that entered the White House with him. Even those sympathetic to Jackson reacted with scorn to King Mob, and with good reason. The throng jumped on chairs with muddy boots, tore curtains and clothes, smashed china, and in general, raised hell. To lure them out, White House valets dragged liquor stocks onto the front lawn, then slammed the doors shut. But Jackson had already left his adoring fans, having escaped out a back window to have a steak dinner at a fancy eatery. The entire shabby event betrayed Jackson's inability to control his supporters on the one hand, and his lack of class and inherent hypocrisy on the other. He had no intention of hanging out with his people, but rather foisted them off on helpless government employees. Jackson ran the country in the same spirit. Having hoisted high the banner of equality, in which any man was as good as another, and dispersed patronage as none before, Old Hickory relied on an entirely different group, elite, select, and skilled, to actually govern the United States. His kitchen cabinet consisted of newspaper editor Francis Preston Blair, scion of a wealthy and influential family, Amos Kendall, his speechwriter as well as editor, the ubiquitous Van Buren, and attorney Roger B. Taney. These individuals had official positions as well. Kendall received a Treasury auditorship, and Taney would be rewarded with a Supreme Court nomination. Perhaps if the Peggy Eaton affair had not occurred, Jackson might have governed in a more traditional manner, but the imbroglio of scandal never seemed far from him. Out of loyalty, he selected as Secretary of War an old friend, John Eaton, who had recently married a pretty 29-year-old widow named Peggy. She came with a reputation. In the parlance of the day, other cabinet wives called Peggy a whore, and claimed she had slept with at least 20 men quite apart from Eaton. Her first husband, an alcoholic sailor, committed suicide after learning of her extramarital shenanigans with Eaton. To the matrons of Washington, most of whom were older and much less attractive, Peggy Eaton posed the worst kind of threat, challenging their propriety, their mores, and their sexuality. They shunned her. Mrs. Calhoun refused even to travel to Washington so as to avoid having to meet Peggy. Adams gleefully noted that the Eaton affair divided the administration into moral factions headed by Calhoun and Van Buren, a widower who hosted the only parties to which the Eatons were invited, a group Adams called the Party of the Frail Sisterhood. Convinced that his own Rachel, who had been socially spurned because of the troubled divorce and its legality, had died in 1828 of what he thought was a broken heart, Jackson saw much of his departed Rachel in Peggy Eaton and wanted her ostracizing to end. He demanded that the cabinet members bring their wives in line and invite Peggy to dinner parties or face dismissal. But Jackson could not even escape Eaton malaria at church, where the local Presbyterian minister, J.M. Campbell, obliquely lectured the president on morality. A worse critic from the pulpit, the Reverend Ezra Style Ely of Philadelphia, was, along with Campbell, summoned to an unusual cabinet meeting in September 1829, where Jackson grilled them on their information about Peggy. Jackson likely regretted the move when Ely brought up new vicious charges against the Eatons, and he uttered, "By the God Eternal," at pointed intervals. "She is chaste as a virgin," Jackson exclaimed. The affair ended when Peggy Eaton withdrew from Washington social life, but Calhoun paid a price as well by alienating the president, who fell completely under the spell of Van Buren. When William Eaton died 27 years later, Peggy Eaton inherited a small fortune, married an Italian dance teacher, then was left penniless when he absconded with her inheritance. Meanwhile, she had indirectly convinced Jackson to rely almost exclusively on his kitchen cabinet for policy decisions. With high irony, the man of the people retreated to the confidence of a select, secret few whose deliberations and advice remained well outside of the sight of the public. Historians such as Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and others have tried to portray the triumph of Jackson as a watershed in democratic processes. That view held sway until so-called social historians like Lee Benson and Edward Pessin, using quantitative methodology, exposed such claims as fantasy. Thus, unable any longer to portray Jackson as a hero of the common man, modern liberal historians somewhat predictably have revised the old mythology of Jacksonian democracy, now explained and qualified in terms of a white man's democracy that rested on the subjugation of slaves, women, and Indians. Andrew Jackson, Indian Fighter. For several generations, Europeans had encroached on Indian lands and, through a process of treaties and outright confiscation through war, steadily acquired more land to the west. Several alternative policies had been attempted by the United States government in its dealings with the Indians. One emphasized the nationhood of the tribe and sought to conduct foreign policy with Indian tribes the way the United States would deal with a European power. Another, more frequent process involved exchanging treaty promises and goods for Indian land in an attempt to keep the races separate. But the continuous flow of settlers, first into the Ohio and Mohawk valleys, then into the backwoods of the Carolinas, Kentucky, Georgia, and Alabama, caused the treaties to be broken, usually by whites, almost as soon as the signatures were affixed. Andrew Jackson had a typically Western attitude toward Indians, respecting their fighting ability, while nonetheless viewing them as savages who possessed no inherent rights. Old Hickory's campaigns in the Creek and Seminole Wars made clear his willingness to use force to move Indians from their territories. When Jackson was elected, he announced a just, humane, liberal policy that would remove the Indians west of the Mississippi River, a proposal that itself merely copied previous suggestions by John C. Calhoun, James Monroe, and others. Jackson's removal bill floundered, however, barely passing the House. National Republicans fought it on the grounds that legislative government was the very essence of republicanism, whereas Jackson represented executive government, which ultimately led to despotism. Put another way, Indian removal exemplified the myth of the Jacksonian Democrats as the party of small government. No doubt the Jacksonians wanted their opponents' power and influence shrunk, but that never seemed to translate into actual reductions in Jackson's autonomy. In 1825, a group of Creek Indians agreed to a treaty to turn over land to the state of Georgia, but a tribal council quickly repudiated the deal as unrepresentative of all the Creek. One problem lay in the fact that whites often did not know which chiefs, indeed, spoke for the nation. Therefore, whichever one best fit the settlers' plan was the one representatives tended to accept as legitimate. Before the end of the year, troops from Georgia had forced the Creek out. A more formidable obstacle, the Cherokee, held significant land in Tennessee, Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama. The Cherokee had a written constitution, representative government, newspapers, and in all ways epitomized the civilization many whites claimed they wanted the tribes to achieve. But the Cherokee also had sided with the British in the Revolutionary War and had attacked settlements in Georgia and the Carolinas on the frontier while the British worked inland from the coast. Jackson, like many in North Carolina, harbored a grudge against a tribe he felt had stabbed the Patriots in the back, and to some extent saw an opportunity to settle an old score. Land hunger again drove the state of Georgia to try to evict the tribe, which implored Jackson for help. This time Jackson claimed the states were sovereign over the people within their borders and refused to intervene on their behalf. Yet his supporters then drafted a thoroughly interventionist removal bill, called by Jackson's most sympathetic biographer, harsh, arrogant, and racist, passed in 1830, with the final version encapsulating Jackson's basic assumptions about the Indians. The bill discounted the notion that Indians had any rights whatsoever, certainly not treaty rights, and stated that the government not only had that authority, but the duty to relocate Indians whenever it pleased. In fact, the removal bill did not authorize unilateral abrogation of the treaties or forced relocation. Jackson personally acceded congressional authority to displace the natives. Jackson's supporters repeatedly promised any relocation would be free and voluntary, and to enforce the removal, the president had to ride roughshod over Congress. Faced with such realities, some Cherokee accepted the state of Georgia's offer of $68 million and 32 million acres of land west of the Mississippi for 100 million acres of Georgia land. Others, however, with the help of two New England missionaries who deliberately violated Georgia law to bring the case to trial, filed appeals in the federal court system. In 1831, the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia reached the United States Supreme Court, wherein the Cherokee claimed their status as a sovereign nation subject to similar treatment under treaty as foreign states. The Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice Marshall, rejected the Cherokee definition of sovereign nation based on the fact that they resided entirely within the borders of the United States. However, he and the court strongly implied that they would hear a challenge to Georgia's law on other grounds, particularly the state's violation of federal treaty powers under the Constitution. The subsequent case, Worcester v. Georgia, 1832, resulted in a different ruling. Marshall's court stated that Georgia could not violate Cherokee land rights because those rights were protected under the jurisdiction of the federal government. Jackson muttered, "John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it," and proceeded to ignore the Supreme Court's ruling. Ultimately, the Cherokee learned that having the highest court in the land and even Congress on their side meant little to a president who disregarded the rule of law and the sovereignty of the states when it suited him. In 1838, General Winfield Scott arrived with an army and demanded that the emigration must be commenced in haste, but without disorder, and he implored the Cherokee not to resist. Cherokee Chief John Ross continued to appeal to Washington right up to the moment he left camp. "Have we done any wrong? We are not charged with any. We have a country which others covet. This is the offense we have ever yet been charged with." Ross's entreaties fell on deaf ears. Scott pushed more than 12,000 Cherokee along the Trail of Tears toward Oklahoma, which was designated Indian Territory, a journey in which 3,000 Indians died of starvation or disease along the way. Visitors who came in contact with the traveling Cherokee learned that the Indians buried 14 or 15 at every stopping place. Nevertheless, the bureaucracy and Jackson was satisfied. The Commissioner on Indian Affairs, in his 1839 report, astonishingly called the episode a striking example of the liberality of the government, claiming that good feeling has been preserved and we have quietly and gently transported 18,000 friends to the west bank of the Mississippi. From the Indians' perspective, the obvious maxim, "with friends like these," no doubt came to mind. But from another perspective, the Cherokee, despite the horrendous cost they paid then and in the Civil War, when the tribe, like the nation, had warriors fighting on both sides, ultimately triumphed. They survived and prospered, commemorating their Trail of Tears and their refusal to be victims. Other tribes relocated or were crushed. When Jackson attempted to remove Chief Black Hawk and the Sauk and Fox Indians in Illinois, Black Hawk resisted. The Illinois militia pursued the Indians into Wisconsin territory, where at Bad Axe they utterly destroyed the warriors and slaughtered women and children as well. The Seminole in Florida also staged a campaign of resistance that took nearly a decade to quell and ended only when Osceola, the Seminole chief, was treacherously captured under the auspices of a white flag in 1837. It would be several decades before Eastern whites began to reassess their treatment of the Indians with any remorse or taint of conscience. Internal improvements and tariff wars. If John Quincy Adams wished upon Jackson a thorn in the flesh, he certainly did so with the tariff bill, which continued to irritate throughout the transition between administrations. By the time the smoke cleared in the war over the so-called Tariff of Abominations, it had made hypocrites out of the tariff's major opponent, John C. Calhoun, and Andrew Jackson, who found himself maneuvered into enforcing it. In part, the tariff issue was the flip side of the internal improvements coin. Since Jefferson's day, there had been calls for using the power and wealth of the federal government to improve transportation networks throughout the Union. In particular, advocates of federal assistance emphasized two key areas, road building and river and harbor improvements. In the case of road building, which was substantially done by private companies, Congress had authorized a national highway in 1806 from Cumberland, Maryland, westward. Construction actually did not start until 1811, and the road reached Wheeling, Virginia in 1818. Work was fitful, after all, with Congress voting funds on some occasions and failing to do so on others. By 1850, the road stretched to Illinois, and it constituted a formidable example of highway construction compared to many other American roads. Paved with stone and gravel, it represented a major leap over corduroy roads made of logs laid side by side, or flat plank roads. More typical of road construction efforts was the Lancaster Turnpike, connecting Philadelphia to Lancaster, and completed in 1794 at a cost of $500,000. Like other private roads, it charged a fee for use, which tollhouse dodgers carefully avoided by finding novel entrances onto the highway past the tollhouse. Hence, roads such as this gained the nickname Shunpikes for the short detours people found around the tollhouses. The private road companies never solved this free rider problem. While the Pennsylvania Road proved profitable for a time, most private roads went bankrupt, but not before constructing some 10,000 miles of highways. Instead, road builders increasingly went to the state, then the federal government, for help. Jefferson's own Treasury Secretary, Albert Gallatin, had proposed a massive system of federally funded canals and roads in 1808, and while the issue lay dormant during the War of 1812, internal improvements again came to the fore in Monroe's administration. National Republicans argued for these projects on the ground that they, obviously to them, were needed, but also in a more ethereal sense that such systems would tie the nation together and further dampen the hostilities over slavery. When Jackson swept into office, he did so ostensibly as an advocate of states' rights. Thus, his veto of the Maysville Road Bill of 1830 seemed to fit the myth of Jackson, the small government president. However, the Maysville Road in Kentucky would have benefited Jackson's hated rival Henry Clay, and it lay entirely within the state of Kentucky. Other projects, however, run by Democrats, fared much better. Jackson approved large appropriations for river and harbor improvement bills and similar pork barrel legislation sponsored by worthy Democrats in return for local election support. In short, Jackson's purported reluctance to expand the power of the federal government only applied when his political opponents took the hit. Battles over internal improvements irritated Jackson's foes, but the tariff bill positively galvanized them. Faced with the tariff, Vice President Calhoun continued his metamorphosis from a big government war hawk into a proponent of states' rights and limited federal power. Jackson, meanwhile, following Van Buren's campaign prescription, had claimed to oppose the tariff as an example of excessive federal power. However distasteful, Jackson had to enforce collection of the tariff, realizing that many of his party's constituents had benefited from it. For 4 years, anti-tariff forces demanded revision of the 1828 Tariff of Abominations. Calhoun had written his South Carolina Exposition and Protest to curb a growing secessionist impulse in the South by offering, in new wineskins, the doctrine of nullification of federal laws. The notion seemed entirely Lockean in its heritage, and Calhoun seemed to echo Madison's interposition arguments raised against the Alien and Sedition Acts. At its core, though, Calhoun's claims were both constitutionally and historically wrong. He contended that the unjust creation of federal powers violated the states' rights provision of the Constitution. This was an anti-federalist theme that he had further fleshed out to incorporate the compact theory of union, in which the United States was a collection of states joined to each other only by common consent or compact, rather than a nation of people who happened to be residents of particular states. Claiming sovereign power for the state, Calhoun maintained that citizens of a state could hold special conventions to nullify and invalidate any national law, unless the federal government could obtain a constitutional amendment to remove all doubt about the validity of the law. In the case of the tariff, however, and more importantly, the underlying issue of slavery about which he was more concerned, there was no guarantee that even proper amendments would have satisfied Calhoun, and without doubt, no constitutional amendment on slavery would have been accepted as legitimate. Many saw the tariff debate itself as a referendum of sorts on slavery. Nathan Appleton, a textile manufacturer in Massachusetts, noted that Southerners' hostility to the tariff arose from the fear and apprehension of the South that the general government may one day interfere with the right of property in slaves. This is the bond which unites the South in a solid phalanx. Adoption of the infamous gag rule a few years later would reinforce Appleton's assessment that whatever differences the sections had over the tariff and internal improvements on their own merits, the disagreement ultimately came down to slavery, which, despite the efforts of the new Democratic Party to exclude it from debate, increasingly wormed its way into almost all legislation. Amid the tariff controversy, for example, slavery also insinuated itself into the Webster-Hayne debate over public lands. Originating in a resolution by Senator Samuel Foote of Connecticut, which would have restricted land sales in the West, it evoked the ire of Westerners and Southerners who saw it as an attempt to throttle settlement and indirectly provide a cheap workforce for Eastern manufacturers. Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri, a staunch Jackson man who denounced the bill, found an ally in Robert Y. Hayne of South Carolina. Hayne contended that the bill placed undue hardships on one section in favor of another, which was the essence of the dissatisfaction with the tariff as well. During the Adams administration, Benton had proposed a reduction on the price of Western lands from 75 to 50 cents per acre. And then, if no one purchased Western land at that price, he advocated giving the land away. Westerners applauded Benton's plan, but manufacturers thought it another tactic to lure factory workers to the West. Land and tariffs were inextricably intertwined in that they provided the two chief sources of federal revenue. If land revenues declined, opponents of the tariff would have to acknowledge its necessity as a revenue source. National Republicans, on the other hand, wanted to keep land prices and tariff rates high, but through a process of distribution, turn the excess monies back to the states for them to use for internal improvement. Closing Western lands also threatened the slave South, whose own soil had started to play out. Already the Black Belt of slaves, which in 1820 had been concentrated in Virginia and the Carolinas, had shifted slowly to the southwest into Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. If the North wished to permanently subjugate the South as a section, which many Southerners, such as Calhoun, feared, the dual-pronged policy of shutting down Western land sales and enacting a high tariff would achieve that objective in due time. This was the case made by Senator Hayne in 1830 when he spoke on the Senate floor against Foote's bill, quickly moving from the issue of land to nullification. Hayne outlined a broad conspiracy by the North against Westerners and Southerners. His defense of nullification merely involved a reiteration of Calhoun's compact theories presented in his exposition, conjuring up images of sectional tyranny and dangers posed by propertied classes. The eloquent Black Dan Webster challenged Hayne, raising the specter of civil war if sectional interests were allowed to grow and fester. Although he saved his most charged rhetoric for last, Webster envisioned a point where two sections, one backward and feudal, one advanced and free, stood apart from each other. He warned that the people, not state legislatures, comprised the Union, or, as he said, the Union was a creature of the people. To allow states to nullify specific federal laws would turn the Constitution into a rope of sand, Webster observed, hence the existence of the Supreme Court to weigh the constitutionality of laws. Liberty and the Union were not antithetical, noted Webster. They were forever one and inseparable. The Foote resolution went down to defeat. Jackson, who sat in the audience during the Webster-Hayne debate, again abandoned the states' rights, small government view in favor of the federal government. At a Jefferson Day dinner attended by Calhoun, Jackson, and Van Buren, Jackson offered a toast directed at Calhoun, stating, "Our Union, it must be preserved." Calhoun offered an ineffectual retort in his toast, "The Union, next to our liberty, most dear." But the president had made his point, and it widened the rift between the two men. An odd coalition to reduce tariff rates arose in the meantime between Jackson and the newly elected National Republican Congressman from Massachusetts, John Quincy Adams. Adams had become the only president in American history to lose an election and return to office as a congressman. He would soon become a leader of the new Whig Party and then Speaker of the House. The revised Adams-sponsored tariff bill cut duties and eliminated the worst elements of the 1828 tariff, but increased duties on iron and cloth. South Carolina's anti-tariff forces were not appeased by the revisions, nor intimidated by Jackson's rhetoric. In 1832, the legislature, in a special session, established a state convention to adopt an ordinance of nullification that nullified both the 1828 and the 1832 tariff bills. South Carolina's convention further authorized the legislature to refuse to collect federal customs duties at South Carolina ports after February 1, 1833, and, should federal troops be sent to collect those duties, to secede from the Union. Calhoun resigned the vice presidency and joined the nullification movement that advanced his theories, and soon ran for the U.S. Senate. Jackson now faced a dilemma. He could not permit South Carolina to bandy about such language. Nullification, he rightly noted, was incompatible with the existence of the Union. More pointedly, he added, "Be not deceived by names. Disunion by armed force is treason." The modern reader should pause to consider that Jackson specifically was charging John C. Calhoun with treason, an accurate application in this case, but still remarkable in its forthrightness and clarity, not to mention courage, which Old Hickory never lacked. Jackson then applied a carrot-and-stick approach, beginning with the stick. He requested that Congress pass the Force Act in January 1833, which allowed him to send military forces to collect the duties. It constituted something of a bluff, since the executive already had such powers. In reality, both he and South Carolinians knew that federal troops would constitute no less than an occupation force. The use of federal troops in the South threatened to bring on the Civil War that Jefferson, Van Buren, and others had feared. Yet Jackson wanted to prove his willingness to fight over the issue, which in his mind remained Union. He dispatched General Winfield Scott and additional troops to Charleston, making plain his intention to collect the customs duties. At the same time, Jackson had no interest in the central issue and the underlying cause of the dissatisfaction with the tariff, slavery, nor did he intend to allow the tariff to spin out of control. While acting bellicose in public, Jackson worked behind the scenes to persuade South Carolina to back down. Here, Jackson received support from his other political adversary, Henry Clay, who worked with Calhoun to draft a compromise tariff with greatly reduced duties beginning in 1833 and thereafter until 1842. Upon signing the bill, Jackson gloated, "The modified tariff has killed the ultras, both tariffites and nullifiers," although he also praised the united influence of Calhoun, Clay, and Webster. Then Congress passed both the tariff reduction and the force bill together, brandishing both threat and reward in plain sight. After the tariff of 1833 passed, Clay won accolades again as the great compromiser. Calhoun had earned Jackson's scorn as a sectional agitator, but Jackson, although he had temporarily preserved the Union, had merely skirted the real issue once again by pushing slavery off to be dealt with by another generation. Far from revealing a visionary leader, the episode exposed Jackson as supremely patriotic but shallow. It reinforced the sense of entitlement that the government has to revenue and its willingness, even eagerness, to use force to keep its money train on track. Jackson's behavior likewise reflected his natural bellicosity, but more important, his penchant for wielding government power, soon to be repeated. In his election defeat to Adams, then his clash with Calhoun, he personalized party, sectional, and ideological conflicts, boiling them down into political bare-knuckle fighting. He stood for union, that much was assured. But to what end? For what purpose? Jackson's next challenge, the war with the Bank of the United States, would again degenerate into a mano-a-mano struggle with a private individual and leave principle adrift. Jackson's War on the BUS. Having deflated the Nationalist Republicans' programs on internal improvements and tariffs, there remained only one plank of their platform to be dismantled: the Second Bank of the United States. Again, a great mythology arose over Jackson and his attitude toward the BUS. Traditional interpretations have held that the small government-oriented Jackson saw the BUS as a creature in the grip of moneyed elites who favored business interests over the common man. A hard money man, so the story goes, Jackson sought to eliminate all paper money and put the country on a gold standard. Having a government-sponsored